Going online without ExpressVPN is like confessing your sins at church, but everyone can read your mind. You may not have anything to hide, but is it really everyone's business? This is why everyone needs a VPN, because all your traffic flows through their servers. Internet service providers, including mobile network providers, know every single website you visit. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers, so your internet service provider can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN will hide your IP address, making it extremely difficult for third parties to track your online activity. All you have to do is fire up the app and click one button to get protected. I use ExpressVPN personally to protect my online activity from hackers, spammers, and the deep state. Protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/matter. That's expressvpn.com/matter. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/matter. There's a new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions called Morning Kick. It combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. All you do is mix with water, stir, and enjoy. It tastes like strawberry lemonade, not like ground-up spinach. Morning Kick is part of my daily routine. It's replaced orange juice in my life as the first place I go when I wake up. And since I've been drinking it, I've had better digestion and more energy. For me, that's important now that I have a newborn who, let's just say, doesn't always sleep like a baby. My health is important to me, just like it's important to you. I want to be the best version of myself spiritually, mentally, and physically. If you feel sluggish, it's worth giving Morning Kick a try. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/HARRIS today. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. This is an unannounced podcast, so I'm not sure how many people we'll have. We'll see. I wanted to just follow up on some things I didn't get to yesterday and clarify a few things too, because there were a few questions after I stopped recording. If we have time, I don't think we will, but if we do, I will go into a Russell Moore podcast that I listened today and a few clips from it. So we'll see if we have the time to go into that. I listened to Russell Moore and I listened to a Michael Horton pot. Well, was it? I don't know what it was. It was a panel discussion. Gospel Coalition put it out, and later in the week, hopefully I'll be able to get to that and we can talk about that as well. But I'm here for questions. If anyone enters the chat and has any questions about anything that's been going on, I will do my best in the limits of my abilities. So the first thing I was going to talk about yesterday that I didn't get to talk about is the GOP platforms. And this is related to the broader discussion about abortion, pro-life, and the future of the GOP on this particular topic. And I have hope that I've never heard anyone else articulate this, but I have a little bit of hope. So I want to give you a white pill. Can I do that? Because I think we need it. But this isn't just some kind of Pollyanna. I'm as I see Donald Trump say things that are wishy-washy about abortion, I'm just holding on to some kind of naive, dream that I have. That's not what it is. I actually see something that I think could be a game changer. So I want to share that with you. And T. James Boone, you were the first one to leave a comment here. Yay, made it for another live broadcast. Probably because I'm doing them later in the evening. At least I did yesterday and today. Your ears are not going to bleed, T. James, if we talk about Russell Moore, I promise you. I'm not going to talk about it. There's only like three clips I want to share from the podcast that he did. It's really, there's not a lot of new things. He keeps recycling the same talking points, right? So, but yeah, we're going to have some white pills, hopefully, or at least one white pill. So I want to show you something, and I'll express why I think this is significant and how this relates indirectly to, I think, the life issue. So this is the Republican platform 2012. We could go back farther, but let's just go back to 2012. I'm going to type in the phrase equal. Okay. So this will bring up equality or equal. Second paragraph, the pursuit of opportunity has defined America from our beginning. This is the land of opportunity. The American dream is a dream of equal opportunity for all. And the Republican Party is the party of opportunity. Now, this is better than equality in the sense of equal outcomes, but this is also a problem. And I know many others have made this point as well, but we don't even start out with equal opportunity. Now, if you mean equality before the law in the sense that if you violate a moral law that's encoded in our legal statutes, you will be punished for it. That's one thing, right? But this is a bit ambiguous. And I think there's opportunity here to insert whatever you want. There's enough room in something like this to have the proposition nation. And if you listen to this podcast for any length of time, you know that proposition nation is this understanding of America, and it often flows with American exceptionalism of a certain variety. I believe in a different variety of American exceptionalism based on the sacrifices and the heroes and the things that actually I think truly really made America prosperous and great and all the rest. But the version we often hear is that there were these ideas. These ideas were embedded in places like the Declaration of Independence and perhaps other founding documents like the Constitution, maybe the Mayflower Compact, but mostly the Declaration of Independence, specifically the second paragraph. And this idea of equality. And this idea of equality is what America is. And even though the founders didn't live up to this, it was for later generations, as Lincoln also said himself, it was going to be later generations who would eventually realize this. And this has just grown and grown and grown to the point of anyone can really be an American. It's not a place, really. It's not a people, really. It's not anything that's intrinsic to the tangible, temporal world that we live in. It's more of this abstract concept that's somewhat nebulous of equality. And so this is, I think, serves a politically useful, it can be a politically useful tool for both sides, because when they talk about equality, if you're against a particular policy that's supposed to provide equality, then you're in danger of not being an American. You're out of step with everyone, right? So that's a very brief primer on what the proposition nation is. But you have language, this comes up 10 times, the term equal. I'm not saying it's wrong every time, but it's heavily laden with this particular phrase. It says, we are the party of the Constitution, the solemn compact, which confirms our God-given individual rights and assures that all Americans stand equal before the law. Which, you know, that's probably the only equality that I'm really willing to defend publicly. I'd have to think about it, but I think that equality before the law, or equal worth in the eyes of God, I'll defend those things. But when it comes to other kinds of social equality, I just see the left using these things to forward its own goals for egalitarianism. It says, we affirm the right of students to engage in prayer in public schools, to have equal access to public schools, equally important. We'll say 9 times, because that's not really treating equal in the same way. Here's another one. In this country, the rule of law guarantees equal treatment to every individual, including more than 1 million immigrants, to whom we grant permanent residence every year. Now you're starting to hear a little bit of, wait a minute, hold on, equal treatment to every individual. Okay, what does that mean? 1 million immigrants to whom we grant permanent residence every year. Now, maybe there's no problem with this, okay? Which is fine. I'm fine saying, okay, there's no problem with, we've decided as a country to come together and say, we're immigrants, we're gonna treat them the same way we treat citizens. We grant them permanent residence, and then they become part of us. There's an assimilation process. We've all agreed on what this is. I don't know that there is agreement on this quite anymore, to be quite honest. This is back from 2012. But you can see, though, that this equal is used throughout this as a high, noble, moral principle. And equalize the tax treatment of group and individual health insurance plan. More money alone does not equal better. That's not, I will say, we'll say 8 times. All right. So that I'm going to discount that one. Let's see here. What else do we have that I want? Okay. So a lot of these other statements aren't about equality in the terms of equal before the law, equal outcomes, or equal opportunity. But you do see this coming up a few times in the document. And it's also tied to the intrinsic to, fundamental to, basic to what America is. Now, in 2016, if you type this in, equal, the term comes up 14 times. And again, it's near the beginning. It says, we affirm as the Declaration of Independence did that all are created equal, endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is fine. That is in the Declaration of Independence. I just wrote a paper or a section for my book 2 weeks ago now, a week and a half ago on this. And I think most of us, like 99% of the time you hear this brought up, should I say 99? Okay, 90% of the time you hear this brought up, it means something completely different than what the founders were thinking. They were thinking equal in a state of nature. They were not thinking that this meant equality in domestic social institutions. I think there was no thought probably further from their minds. And in fact, they make this very clear the next year when Vermont petitions the Continental Congress, the same Continental Congress that approved this language, and says, New Hampshire granted us lands, and New York is giving us a problem and saying these lands belong to them, and they're violating our rights, our inalienable rights. And so you just wrote a Declaration of Independence. What are you going to do about it? And the Continental Congress basically writes back and said, well, actually, what we were doing in that was we were representing 13 distinct corporate bodies, states, and how their rights, their rights that they would have been afforded under the British unwritten constitution, were violated by England and not defended by the king. So they were saying that we were representing these corporate entities, the body politic. We weren't representing individuals with their gripes. It wasn't about domestic institutions. And this is one of the things I think that's very confusing, but and I'm not saying the error is present in this, they're just quoting it, but oftentimes when it's brought up, I think it's portrayed inaccurately. It says, it talks about competition, competitiveness. This is using equal again in a different way, but so I'll skip over that one. Let's see, that God bestows certain, here it is, inalienable rights on every individual, thus producing human equality. Okay, what does that mean though? That government exists first and foremost to protect those inalienable rights, that man-made law must be consistent with God-given natural rights, and that if God-given natural and inalienable rights come in conflict with government, court, or human-granted rights, God-given natural inalienable rights always prevail. Inalienable, by the way, just means cannot be given up. This is what God endows people with in a state of nature. This, according to the founding generation, how they would have thought of this, it's what they are given in a state of nature without any government, they haven't entered society yet. This is just what you have. When you enter society, though, you give up some of these, or I should say give up's not the best word. They get amended. Some of these get given to the government or society to then administer. So I'm trying to give it a good example. Like in a state of nature, there is nothing prohibiting a minor from driving a car. Okay. Transporting oneself. Freedom of movement. This is something that would be, in a state of nature, something that no one can tell you no. It's something that God has given to you, and government should secure this. Government should guarantee that you're able to have freedom of movement, let's say. All right. I'm using a more modern example if it were written today. But we know in society, when you enter society, there's other people that you have to be concerned with. And so there's safety laws. There's minimum requirements for getting a driver's license. You can't be 15 and get one. You have to be 16, or in some states, 18 or 17. There's regulations that come with this. So you actually amend those inalienable rights in a state of society, right? And that the inalienable rights that they were complaining about, the things that they were saying shouldn't be given up, were inalienable rights that were amended or they were secured under a British constitution. So that's the context of the founding. So there is this, you have a slight individual aspect in the argument at the beginning, but then it very quickly moves into, and even at the beginning, actually, it sort of just deviates for a moment. It starts with it's these state entities, it's these corporate bodies that are complaining about what the king is doing to abridge their rights as conglomerates, not as individuals who are saying that, you know, they're not making sweeping statements about domestic relationships. They're not, in fact, slavery being one of the ones that's brought up most often. The second to last complaint they have in the Declaration of Independence is that Lord Dunmore in Virginia, the royal governor, is fomenting slave insurrections. And the reason he's doing that is because he is telling them that if they join the British army, they will gain their freedom and then they will be free and they can fight against their masters. This is a real problem, right, for the colonists. And they're complaining about this and saying, this is violating our rights. Well, how is that possible? Because they were mediated through a tradition, this British tradition. And so I just think that, let's see, we'll keep reading here. But I think that historical background is important in understanding this. And of course, if this is too much, if this is just overload, I will have more information coming about that in due time so you know exactly what the founders meant, what at least the Continental Congress meant when they were talking about this. But it wasn't the main thing that was remembered about the document. It wasn't seen as the cornerstone. It was boilerplate stuff. It was like at the time, it was not something that was seen as super innovative. It was at all. In fact, Jefferson later writes and says, we weren't trying to be innovative. So now it's seen as this great experiment, this new idea of liberty, this new grand thing that that was farthest thing from their minds. Let's see. I think you get kind of that treatment here. Let's see. I think I lost my place. All right. So it says, God-given natural inalienable rights always prevail, that there's a moral law recognized as the laws of nature and nature's God, and that the American government is to operate within the consent of the governed. We are also the party of the Constitution, the greatest political document ever written. It is the solemn compact built upon the principles of the Declaration that enshrines our God-given individual rights and ensures that all Americans stand equal before the law, defines the purposes and limits of government, and is the blueprint for ordered liberty that makes the United States the world's freest and most prosperous nation. Most of that, I think, is not bad. But I just want you to notice how emphasized that term equal is. It says, we reaffirm the Constitution's fundamental principle, limited government, separation of powers, individual liberty, and rule of law. We denounce bigotry. Now, this is interesting because this is the founders would have been bigots by their standards of 2016, right? We denounce bigotry, racism, anti-Semitism, ethnic prejudice, and religious intolerance. Therefore, we oppose discrimination based on sex, race, religion, creed, disability, or national origin, and support statutes to end such discrimination. As the party of Abraham Lincoln, we must continue to foster solutions to America's difficult challenge when it comes to race relations. Today, we continue to encourage equality for all citizens and access to the American dream. Now, this opens up all kinds of policies when you say that. If you want to encourage equality for all citizens and access to the American dream, what does that look like? It says merit and hard work should determine advancement in our society, so we reject unfair preferences, quotas, and set-asides as form of discrimination. Our ranks include Americans from every faith and tradition, and we respect the right of every American to follow his deeply held belief. Now, I could keep reading, but you do see in some of the language here, this would mean a multicultural setting of some kind. Lincoln did not understand that line in the Declaration of Independence the same way the founding generation would have understood it, the way they were using it. Lincoln, in fact, even said at one point that this was for later use, that this was put in there for later use, which would have been news to them. It wasn't even a governing document. It wasn't certainly not like the Articles of Confederation or the Constitution later. So this has become, though, the cornerstone. This has become, equality has become the animating feature, the definitive feature of America. It is used for just about every policy. There's has to be some kind of an element of equality between peoples, equal access to school facilities. Let's see, the equality comes up quite a bit in this. Let's see if I want to focus on any of these. We will also reform the Equal Access to Justice Act to cap and disclose payments made to environmental activists. Let's see here. That's not really related. It talks about, again, it's amazing that it keeps talking about this. The federal government should not be a partner in that, talking about a certain policy thing. I'm just going to skip ahead. As the Constitution gives it no role in education, at the heart, here it is, of the American experiment lies the greatest political expression of human dignity. The self-evident truth that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with their by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That truth rejects the dark view of an individual as human capital, a possession for the creation of another's wealth. I'm not sure that was in the minds of the founders, but the sentiment, we can kind of get around the sentiment here. Like, you're talking about a society that had chattel slavery, right? When you're talking about the founding generation. In fact, it was written by, it came out of Virginia, right? And some people think, and they're probably right, somewhat based off of the preamble in the Virginia Bill of Rights. So they didn't see things the same way. All right, I think we're going to... All right, that's pretty much it for what I wanted to focus on. Now, is this stuff a glaring problem? Is this stuff... is this the worst thing in the world that this language is in there? I don't know. I'm not saying it's the worst thing in the world, but what I'm saying is the Democrats emphasize this, and I've talked about this before, in their party platforms. If you go to their 2020 platform, it literally starts with America is an idea. And what is the idea? It's equality. If you go to their current platform, it says very similar things in the document. The Republicans are holding back equality. And they're there to ensure equality. And the Republicans for years were saying kind of the same language. They're using similar language, saying, no, we're about equality. Sometimes the differences was parsed with, well, they're about equal opportunity and the Democrats are about equal outcomes. But I think greater minds than me have made the point that equal opportunity, if you want to level everything so everyone has the same opportunity, it inevitably is going to flow into equal outcomes. And we saw that to some extent with the civil rights movement. That was in the beginning, that was what they were advocating for. We want equal opportunity. And what did it eventually end up with? Quotas, affirmative action. And I would say historians will look back and see 2020 and everything that happened during BLM as an extension of this. It's still going on. Because if you don't have, because the idea is that humans are, they have unfair advantages, and we need to somehow make it so they don't have those anymore. And if we correct that, those unfair advantages, then everyone's going to eventually wind up the same. So it's a flaw that equal opportunity, if we just give people equal opportunity, the flaw will be corrected. But surprise, surprise, humans are still unequal, even if you try to set those metrics. So eventually the question arises, why are things still unequal? The fact is, no one starts even with equal opportunity. No one, because God has created everyone different mentally, physically. He's put people in different geographical areas where they're going to have access to different things. Everyone has unique experiences in this world that will affect them. You can never set things so that everyone will have equal opportunity. It's just impossible. The most you can do is say the law is going to treat citizens in a way that as much as is possible, so that, you know, as the law is able to catch people who break it, they are treated equally by incurring fines and penalties and so forth. But even then, we know that there are all kinds of situations that make that perfect equality before the law in a human society impossible. You're going to have not just evil people who take bribes and people with connections and those kinds of things, but you're going to have people who commit crimes and do things that they shouldn't do outside of the watchful eye of the rest of society. And so it's something to strive for, equality before the law, but equal opportunity, as it's often defined and often thought of, and equal outcomes, I don't find either of those things, the way they're commonly portrayed, as being something that's possible. And when we try to do that, we end up running up against creation, basically. And so anyway, all that to be said, when Christians talk about equality before the creator, they're talking about something I think that's, it can be somewhat similar to what the founding generation would have thought of as people being created equal, that there is this, in a sense, an abstract equality people have in a state of nature. God has given them equal worth. God has given them access to preserving themselves, self-preservation. But when they enter a state of society, when they're living with other human beings, the understanding was that these things become amended in some way. There's different rules for children. There's different rules for women in that society. There's different rules for men. There's different rules for slaves in that society. There's in our own society, we have different rules for different categories, different privileges and so forth for even in our tax code for people with kids, for seniors, for right. So these are all things that are these equal? No, they're not. But there's good reasons behind many of them. All right. So, John, why are you waxing long and eloquent about this? Maybe it's not that eloquent, but why are you telling us about this? I'm leading up to this. I see what we just talked about as the seed of a lot of progressive measures to try to come up to say that America is intrinsically this. So therefore, we need policies that create even Trump's IVF thing right now is basically kind of this. It's you know, there's some couples who are struggling to have kids. We need to make everyone else pay for them to access IVF and stuff, right? These are the kinds of policies that you'll see, not just on the left, but on the right. What was the justification for even invading Iraq? We need to give them equality. That wasn't the whole justification, but that was part of it, that they are under the thumb of a dictator. So we're going to go in there and make them Americans, basically. I think a lot of bad stuff has been promoted, and I don't have time to get into all of that, but if you go along with me on that point, check out the 2024 GOP platform, which is titled Make America Great Again. And I want to show you something. I type in the phrase equal. It comes up three times. That is significant. And there was no platform in 2020. So that's why I didn't skip over 2020. There just wasn't one. Three times? Common sense tells us clearly that the Republican Party must stand for equal treatment for all. Likewise, the Republican Party must ensure that equal application of law to all, regardless of political affiliation or personal beliefs. So it's equality before the law. It's not tied to, it says common sense tells us. That's experience. That's tradition, basically. I mean, it's in that neighborhood. They're not saying that, it's just interesting that they're not framing it in these abstract terms as much. And they're not saying this is intrinsic to America or like that, or that's, you can boil down what America is to equality of some kind. That's it. Then they say universal, you know, school choice. We want to expand 529 education savings accounts and support it, homeschooling families equally. That's it. That's it for the whole document. So what do they think America is then, right? If it's not equality, if it's not this notion that all men are created equal, and that's American exceptionalism, what is America? Let me read this to you. This is the first paragraph of the new Republican platform. It says, our nation's history is filled with the stories of brave men and women who gave everything they had to build America into the greatest nation in history of the world. Generations of American patriots have summoned the American spirit of strength, determination, and love of country to overcome seemingly insurmountable challenges. The American people have proven time and again that we can overcome any obstacle and any force pitted against us. In the early days of our republic, the founding generation defeated what was then the most powerful empire the world has ever seen. In the 20th century, America vanquished Nazism and fascism and then triumphs over Soviet communism after 4 years of the Cold War. I'm going to keep reading. This is great. I'm just telling you, this is really good. If some of you might think, what's the big deal? I'll explain. But now we are a nation in serious decline. Our future, our country, or sorry, our identity, listen to that, our identity and our very way of life are under threat like never before. Today, we must once again call upon the same American spirit that led us to prevail through every challenge of the past if we are going to lead our nation to a brighter future. And then it goes through, you know, how politicians betrayed us, allowing our borders to be overrun, all of the things that they so let me just I want to keep reading, but let me just I'm too excited here. Tell you what I think's going on here. There is a shift happening, and it's freaking out some people. But I'm here for it. Okay, I'm hoping that it lasts. I'm hoping this doesn't just die with Trump. Or I don't think it totally will. I think the imprint is there. America, and this is the difference between the emancipationist narrative I've talked about and the sacrificial narrative. America is a place of heroes. America is a place of sacrifice. America is a place of real, tangible men and women who endured things. America has an identity, and it's a people, and it's what they've accomplished. And they exist within some borders. This is America. They have defining characteristics that are in real life visible in tangible people. You might call this populism. I don't know what other words. I mean, some people might think it's fascism. I also noticed, you might have noticed it too, they went from the founding generation and they skipped to the 20th century. They didn't even talk about, let's see if they even talk about Lincoln. I don't even know if they talk about Lincoln or the Civil War, any of that. They just kind of, Lincoln's not even mentioned. Not once. This, I think the reason that this is good is because this particular phrasing says something very different about America than the other two documents. The other two documents are more abstract, propositional, distant. They're nebulous. They can be used to justify anything, really. This centers what the politician should be doing on how does it benefit real, tangible people that live and work in this country, that have a history to them. This is the ourselves and our posterity, right? From the Constitution. There's a history. It doesn't mean that there's not processes of assimilation and that kind of thing, but you can't ignore the fact that this is there's a real people here, and they deserve better, and they've been abused and mistreated by the ruling class. What does this mean for abortion? I'll tell you. I'm encouraged on the life issue. It's not the only one. Obviously, there's implications for the border issue and all kinds of things. But on the life issue, I'm encouraged, even though this particular platform softens some language. Trump did some bad things. From my understanding, Trump did some bad things. See, there was, at least in some of the previous platforms, there was an attempt to have some regulation on the federal level. Trump has gotten rid of most of that in the party platform. He wants this to be a state issue. Now, it's overturning Roe v. Wade. This was always going to punt most of the things back to the states. But he wants to kind of, I think it's probably because of how unpopular the issue is. He wants to win elections. I mean, that's what he said. I talked about that yesterday in the podcast. That's what he said back in April. We got to win elections. This isn't a popular issue. But he wants this to be a state thing. Okay. I get that. Here's the thing, though. Foundationally speaking, like think root level. If you think about America as a tangible people in a tangible place, and you start conforming everything else, policies, to this notion that it's not about some abstraction. When you're in abstract land, and really, it's not very far from fantasy land. When you're in that world and you're thinking through, I wonder what the eggheads think would be best with their theories, and we should just impose those things. You're not thinking as much about tangible people. You're thinking about satisfying math equations, not really math, but logic. You're thinking of satisfying some theory that someone came up with. But when you're thinking about actual tangible people, and they're the ones you serve, and then it dawns on you that many of these people are dying at very early stages through abortion pills, through abortion procedures, many of them in IVF, related to IVF procedures. They're dying because of selective reduction in these things. You start realizing they're Americans too. They're part of this tangible thing. Now, maybe that doesn't do a lot for some of you. This does a lot for me, though. I actually think that if this takes root over time, inevitably the Republican Party, if they really believe it, is going to have to become more anti-abortion and more pro-life. They're just going to have to. If they stay in abstract land, though, I think they don't, they're not required to as much. Because look, you can make arguments, the Democrats do this all the time. They make arguments for, we need more access to abortion because that's about equality, right? And then the anti-abortionists will come back and say, no, equality means we need equal protection. And we, and I'm not saying we, you shouldn't use that terminology or that's wrong or anything. I think it's fine to use it. But if you're basing the whole thing on some notion of equality, whatever notion it is, instead of, hey, it's just intrinsically wrong to murder a human life. That's it. It's not about equal treatment. We want equal treatment when it comes to murder, really, like across the board, but that's not the thing that makes it wrong. It's not because it's a violation of equality. It's because it's a violation of the Imago Dei. And what's the image of God? It's something that exists, that's very real in every soul, in every person. They have this. That's why it's wrong. And you think, oh, is America an idea or is America people? People with an Imago Dei, something very real that they have, that you can identify in other people. You can't just, I mean, all the dictators in history use some notion of equality to justify killing people because we need, it's not fair that they're alive. They've taken too much. They're taking resources, that kind of thing, whatever. They forfeit their life to satisfy some notion of equality. But when you're trying to satisfy not equality, but the God who designed you and gave you worth because you were made in his image, it's a different thing altogether. And I think if the Republican Party platform ends up continuing to hold this language and they can resist the urge to put nebulous views of equality that are so often abused, misinterpreted, I think that we have a shot on a ground level. I think the poison pill from the left's perspective is there. That's my, I hope that helps some of you. That helps me. I don't know. Tell me if it does or not. I'm taking any questions tonight. So did you see Twitter GC? I don't group chat. Did you see Twitter? Is that what GC means? I don't know. Did I? Watching from the Dominican Republic, Eric Johnson says, T. James Boone says, I'm here for the white pills. Good. Leftists believe the saddled created the horse and not the other way around. It must have been something I said. I don't remember. George W. Bush created No Child Left Behind. Goal was equality in education, co-sponsored with Ted Kennedy. Red Kennedy. That's funny. Matt Borish says this. And that is a great point, Matt. Matt, by the way, is leading music at the conference coming up. We have the men's conference, fundamentalsconference.com. You don't want to miss it. It's coming up in what now, 3 weeks? You need to sign up. We're getting close. But that's a great point. The No Child Left Behind was all about equality, and we're worse off now than we were before he started that. All right. Let's talk about, I have to mention something from the program yesterday. I don't listen to most of my programs. I haven't listened to this, but someone said that I made a mistake and I need to correct this. Now, I don't think it doesn't sound like I made a mistake that I have to like delete the podcast for, because I would if I had to. If I said you should go murder children, and that's not what I meant, but that was the meaning. I would delete the podcast because I don't want to encourage anyone to do anything wrong, obviously. But I obviously didn't say that or imply that. But I did confuse something apparently. And when you're talking about IVF, there is a lot of technical jargon. And yes, I've read a lot about this. Okay, I've consumed a lot of Christian resources about this, and yes, including abolitionist resources. I'm not saying I'm an expert at it, and I'm always open to new resources, but there is a lot of technical information. In fact, I was talking to someone in a chat group who I respect highly on this, who's an abolitionist, and he wants to ban it. And frankly, I do too. I think under the conditions we're in now, if I had a switch that I could just ban all of IVF, I would do it, because there's a very narrow way to use this and for it to be ethical, I think, in any way. I mean, the things associated with it more often than not are not ethical. But that being said, I'm not trying to make excuses for myself, but this person I respect told me, hey, like, I think I was saying fertilized embryo. And he's like, all embryos are fertilized. And I meant, I was confused, fertilized egg, fertilized embryo, same thing, embryo, fertilized egg. But he understood what I was saying, but it is important to have your definitions and your technical jargon right. So I guess I blew it on something, on one little thing. I said selective reduction, and I wasn't talking about selective reduction when I said it. I was talking about something else. So I posted what I meant to say, and it was an email. A very gracious guy said, I got an email saying I referred to early embryonic loss, which is what I was referring to, as selective reduction. I'll correct and clarify, I said on the podcast tonight, which is what I'm doing now. It doesn't affect the argument I was making, which was that this is present in both IVF cycles and natural, you know, just having a sexual relationship, and you're going to have early embryonic loss. And the estimates are that 50 to 70% of embryos are lost in both. Okay. So whether it doesn't, we don't know of any difference it makes. It seems like it's about the same in IVF as it is a cycle, as it is in a, just a natural cycle. As far as we know, this is something that naturally occurs. I remember I was at the University of North Carolina, Duke. I think it was Duke University years ago. And there was a guy who came out. I was trying to evangelize and stuff. And this guy comes out, and that was his main argument. Why does God do all these abortions? And he's like, well, you know, 70% of these embryos they're lost in the womb before they can implant, and or sometimes they will implant, but then very quickly, and especially in twin scenarios, you have 10 to 20% of the time with twins, you'll have two. In fact, I have a friend that just had this happen. He had two, and then one of them is lost. And that is referred to as natural reduction or spontaneous reduction. So I was confusing my terms because I have all these terms floating around. There's natural or spontaneous reduction. There's early embryonic loss, and then, of course, there's selective reduction. Selective reduction, though, is very different. This is what happens in IVF. It's evil. It's murder. It's wrong when they will take these embryos, and they will say, well, you have 10, let's say, hypothetically, and we overstimulated you and made you produce 10. You only want 5, or you only want 3, or you only want 1, whatever the case is. We're going to just delete, you know, these 5. And they'll use clinical language that distances themselves from what they're actually doing. They're killing an embryo, a blastocyst, a zygote, depending on the stage. And so this is something that is evil, that's wrong, obviously. So I just wanted to point that out, that I was talking about, yes, it's not, as far as we know, there's nothing different in IVF as there is in a natural cycle when it comes to early embryonic loss. So if I said yesterday, if I use the term selective reduction instead of embryonic loss, that is on me. I apologize for that. That's not the term that I meant. I said the wrong term there. So someone on Twitter was saying that I never really defined what IVF was to, that I was just saying, I went through this cartoon and said, look, all these things that are associated with IVF or often come alongside of IVF are immoral or have opportunity for immorality. These are ethical dilemmas, but none of them are intrinsic to IVF. In other words, you can have someone who navigates it. And I said in Italy, I'm not saying they're perfect, but there are laws in Italy that severely reduce a lot of these ethical dilemmas because they regulate it very highly in Italy. So I'm not going to reinvent the wheel and give you the podcast I gave yesterday, but I did want to just give you kind of my working definition. So IVF is a mechanism where an egg is retrieved and fertilized by sperm outside the body and then transferred into the uterus. That's pretty much it. That's what IVF is. Now, the stimulants, the hormones they give to women so they produce more eggs, freezing embryos, sperm collection that's immoral, using pornography and these kinds of things, selective reduction, which I just explained. These often, like in most cases, on some level, most of these accompany what I just described as IVF. And so that's why if I had a switch to flip and say, well, let's just make it illegal, I would flip it. No question. But they're not necessarily intrinsic to the process. And again, the point I was making yesterday, and this is why I wanted to say this, is that it is very important if we're going to make the argument socially, politically, as anti-abortion people, which is where I'm at. We can't just frame it as anti-IVF. If we just frame it in a very simplistic fashion, if we don't actually target the actual ethical problems and we just say IVF, I think, and I know because there's whatever many of you think the number is of people who have used this, it's probably more. A lot of people now are using IVF. I think there's probably some underlying issues. There's probably environmental factors, maybe even immunizations. Who knows? Some people say the plastics are causing infertility, but there's an infertility crisis that we are in. It's one of the things I'm hoping that Kennedy, if he gets in, you know, he wants to make America more healthy, right? Let's solve this somehow. I don't know what the deal is, but we need to be informed. We need to know what's going on somehow. So I know there's many, I guess, crunchy, they call them, housewives who are making sure that they're not using plastic and they're eating, they're using vegetable washes so that they don't have pesticides and they're not doing all the immunizations with their kids. And I mean, there's a whole movement now that really was launched mostly in 2020, or at least it got popular because of this kind of thing. Now, because of that, because of the infertility, whatever the cause is, there's a growing IVF. There's also obviously the big, you know, when you hear about it in the news, it's like celebrity couples that are using surrogates, it's homosexuals, but there's a whole lot of people that aren't in those categories that are Catholic, that are Christian. And the point I was making is that you're not going to be able to come to them and just say like IVF is evil, right? Especially if they're ignorant, number one, and they don't understand, or number two, they actually try to navigate this ethically and avoid some of those moral dilemmas that I talked about, but you know, still using IVF. So it's more prudent of us if we can come up with ways to target the actual ethical dilemmas. And what I've said is that I think the biggest ethical dilemma with IVF that trounces all the other ones is the selective reduction. It is the discarding embryos that will not be used. It's a direct murder, right? So now that sounds clinical. Maybe there's a better term, but that process, if that can be targeted first, that's evil. That's wrong. Let's drum up. We need to make that illegal. You shouldn't be able to just kill people, right? This is the same as abortion. Let's treat these embryos, these zygotes, these blastocysts as humans. I think we make a lot more headway than instead of let's take this whole process and then just say we're anti-IVF. Not going to make sense to people ignorant about those ethical issues. And it's going to probably cause, and it's for more people than you think, people who try to navigate this ethically, it's going to probably cause them, it'll turn them off, right? So we can elicit their support, I think. Maybe I'm optimistic, but we can elicit their support. We can also educate people about what's actually going on in many of these clinics if we target the right thing. And I think it's more accurate. That's my whole argument. There you go. All right, I'll take questions on this. I'm in tears due to relief. It sounds like the GOP is finally beginning to care, even if it's out of fear for their own survival. These are all from Big Yehuda. It sounds like the GOP is finally beginning to... you already wrote that. I guess I wrote that. Okay, hold on. I think that homosexuality and dysphoria are being influenced by our poison food. RFK mentioned this, pollution is increasing sin. I think that's probably true. Maybe 10 years ago, I would have said, what are you talking about? Now, obviously, it's moral. At the baseline, this is a moral issue. But I will say this. Yes, when you are ingesting hormone disruptors, plastics, those kinds of things, and when women are taking in more testosterone, and which I haven't looked into all of this deeply, but apparently, like if that's happening, if there's a hormonal thing going on here, that would make sense to me that would contribute to some confusion on gender and these kinds of things. I don't think it's the main cause, but it's a contributing factor, I'm sure. And maybe it's a significant one. You know, maybe it really is something to figure out. So, all right, let's move on. I don't have a lot more to talk to you about. I don't think I'm going to get to the Russell Moore stuff. I do want to talk about the post-war consensus, okay? Let's talk about that. I'm going to pull up my copy of Reno's book, Return of the Strong Gods. And so this guy named Daryl Cooper was on Tucker Carlson yesterday. And if you haven't noticed, if you're not on X or Facebook, you might not know, but this created a large outcry. Al Mohler said, this is a line too far going after Churchill, because that's what Daryl Cooper did. He went after Winston Churchill in one short segment. And of course, he talked about the Jonestown cult. He talked about a number of things, but there was a section on World War II. And Daryl Cooper is a popular podcaster. Martyr Made is his podcast. I have listened to his series on Jeffrey Epstein. That's the only one I've listened to. And I started listening to his series on Appalachia and then stopped, but he's a very good podcaster. It's not like my podcast where it's a different kind of podcast where I am talking to you in a conversational mode. He is very scripted. I think the whole thing's probably written out. And it is long form. Like some of the episodes I think are 7 or 8 hours. I mean, it is long, long form. It's audiobook level stuff, really. But it keeps your interest in ways audiobooks don't. It's brilliant what he does. And I think the Epstein thing I listened to was absolutely phenomenal. It was the best treatment of the subject I've ever seen or heard. And so I didn't know about his World War II stuff. I still don't, because I haven't listened to it. All I know is what I heard on Tucker. That said, he criticized Winston Churchill. And what did he criticize Winston Churchill for? Instigating World War II. I think he called him the chief villain of World War II, which, of course, that's what made everyone lose their mind. You know, Hitler's the chief villain. Now, I said on X, actually, maybe Tojo is the chief villain. Now, my grandfather was in the Pacific Theater. I just know the Japanese, what they did in the Bataan Death March, the rape of Nanking, the way they treated Chinese, the way that they even fought in battle against, I mean, they were the kind of people that would, I don't know what else to call it. It's like suicide bombing, right? And like Iwo Jima and some of these islands that Marines would go into, and then they, you know, come out of caves or ambush them, from the ground, and they just blow up. And they didn't mind forfeiting their lives. They didn't mind. They didn't mind grotesque and is torture too strong a word? I don't think so. Torturous ways of treating their prisoners. Human life did not mean the same thing to them. As even in, you say they didn't to the Nazis either. Yeah, well, in the case of the Nazis, though, they had to think about the groups that they were persecuting in different terms. The Japanese, kind of like across the board, had a barbarism to them, I suppose you could say. Look at the way they even treated themselves. With the Harikaris and the committing suicide if the allies were getting too close. So, honor killings, these kinds of things. It was a different culture, but it was a culture that didn't value life in the same way that Western cultures do. Western cultures have to classify humans as something other than human, or they have to come up with these unique justifications for certain groups, but it's an exception. Whereas I think in Japan, it was more of a rule. And so I don't know why the Pacific Theater seems to get ignored somewhat. I'm just very aware of it, I think, because of my grandfather. But there were some really brutal things that happened there. Now, that aside from that, most people think it's Hitler. Hitler is the chief villain. And of course, there's a great case to be made for that. I would not ever discount someone or refute, like, say you're wrong for saying Hitler's the chief villain of World War II. He did many evil things. The reason Daryl Cooper said what he said about Churchill, though, was not because, and you got to go watch the podcast, it wasn't because of a moral superiority. That's not what he was talking about. He was talking about cause and effect. So he was talking about what Churchill did in, he thinks, fomenting, provoking, instigating World War II, is we would not have had a Holocaust. We would not have had some of the negative effects of World War II if it wasn't for the fact that there was a World War II. And without Winston Churchill, there would not have been a World War II. That's his point. Now, how can you say that? This isn't a new thought. And this way, I haven't I think for some people, this was, when they heard this, they couldn't believe it. I've heard this before, most notably in Pat Buchanan's book. And I'm not sure if their views are exactly the same, but Darryl Cooper cited the fact that it was, I think, the day after or 2 days after Winston Churchill came to office. So World War II's only been going on, I think, a few months at that point. This is early 1940. He orders a bombing of Germany where Darryl Cooper says they're just bombing civilian areas. They're bombing the Black Forest. These aren't military targets. And this was, and Churchill does this to provoke Germany into attacking them. And I think Cooper might even said Germany initially showed some restraint, but Churchill wants a war. Pat Buchanan's main argument on this, which I don't think Cooper brought up, is that Churchill wanted a war, but one of the things he did, there's two major things. He guaranteed Poland's security, which is something that England really didn't have the resources to do, which was foolish of England, knowing that Germany was going to go into Poland. But now, kind of like similar to World War One, you have these alliances and now you have to honor the alliance. The second thing, though, Pat Buchanan, I know, says in his book, I think it's called like Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, which covers World War One and World War Two. I read it years ago, but he says also Churchill did things like he went into like the waters of under the jurisdiction of Sweden and Denmark to try to put mines, I guess, in the water there and things like that, which early on, and that was, it forced Germany or. No one put a gun to their head and said, you have to. Maybe that's how they felt, but it inspired Germany to invade these countries to ensure that England was not gaining a foothold in them, to kind of like flank Germany from the north. And so it provoked everything. And Hitler was early on trying to gain a peace. And for people today are saying, of course he was. I don't know what you want. I mean, it's just history. History's messy. Hitler wanted to gain a peace. He wanted an alliance really bad. Or if he couldn't get an alliance, he wanted at least like, let's not shoot at each other with England. And this was something that was rejected by Churchill. So this is Cooper's argument, is that Churchill rejected these overtures and then he provoked Germany. And so this eventually, they landed in a world war. There was a fumbling that happened and Churchill was the main driving force there. And so the evil that stemmed from that war, this is mostly on Churchill. Doesn't mean there's not blame to share. That's his argument. People are taking this as a morally superior thing all over X, though. They're saying that what Cooper was saying is that Hitler was morally superior to Churchill or something like that. In fact, someone messaged me today and said that this was just pro-Nazi propaganda. It was a Nazi perspective. And I know Pat Buchanan wasn't a pro-Nazi guy at all. In fact, I saw him in an interview just knocking down the Nazis, railing against the Nazis from the 80s. I don't see this as I don't think this is a uniquely like pro-Nazi perspective or something to be critical of Churchill in some ways. I know Churchill too. I was reading something not long ago that he wanted to treat Germany fairly harshly right after the war. And this was in ways that you really, again, there was like an anti-German hatred that he had for leading up to it, from World War I, and you can understand these guys. I mean, they fought in World War One. There's bitterness already there. And then World War II, right? So it wouldn't be a surprising thing. A lot of other stuff is brought up about Churchill and his moral defects, but I think that's the relevant stuff for what Darryl Cooper, AKA Martyr Maid, was saying on Tucker Carlson's podcast. I was being somewhat tongue in cheek and saying things on X to, I guess, mock some of the pushback that Darryl Cooper was getting and Tucker Carlson was getting. So, I actually pushed back against the neo-Nazi thing today too. Maybe I should show you guys, or I'll just say it. I don't have to show you, but on my browser, I have some of it pulled up. I was mocking the fact that it seems like a lot of people, their idea of history is like you have Abraham Lincoln, MLK and Winston Churchill. Like these are, and I made a statement like these are not the founding fathers of Christian civilization or the cornerstones, I think I said, of Christian civilization. And I'm joking. Okay. I'm mocking the people who are so offended that Darryl Cooper said this. I don't know what Darryl Cooper's views are on the rest of World War II or other things, but I'm just saying based on alone what he said on Tucker Carlson, no, that doesn't make you a neo-Nazi or anything like that. One of the things though, I had fun with, I do kind of want to show people this. I'm going to show you guys. Okay. Let me see if I can pull it up for y'all. Okay. So, I think this is hysterical. Maybe it's just my own humor, but I wanted to make people choose this. So, because I knew this. I knew that Churchill had written this. I said, Martyr Maid should have told everyone that Churchill was a neo-Confederate and dropped a few quotes from these books to prove it. Now, Churchill, many don't know this, he wrote a book on the American Civil War in which, let's just say, people like Jefferson Davis come out looking a lot better than Abraham Lincoln. He says at one point, Robert E. Lee was the greatest general the English-speaking peoples have ever produced. I don't know if it's in this book or his book on English-speaking peoples, but here's the other thing. This is the significant thing. If Lee had not won Gettysburg, if you want a wild alternative history, go read this. Winston Churchill wrote it. Here's a quote from the end of that. If this prize should fall to His Imperial Majesty, Emperor Wilhelm II, so assuming that World War I doesn't happen, I guess, he may perhaps reflect how easily his career might have been wrecked in 1914 by the outbreak of a war, which might have cost him his throne. So wait, World War I was averted, which means there's no World War II and no Holocaust, right? And have laid his country on the dust. If today he occupies in old age the most splendid situation in Europe, let him not forget that he might well have found himself eating the bitter bread of exile, a dethroned sovereign and a broken man loaded with unutterable reproach. And this, we repeat, might well have been his fate if Lee had not won the Battle of Gettysburg. So what's the argument here? It's an alternative history. If Lee had won Gettysburg, the South would have won the Civil War. If the South had won the Civil War, then America would not, have entered World War I. You got to go read this essay. This is from Winston Churchill. And so if I had written this, if any person on the right today had written this, they would be denounced as some kind of a crazy neo-Confederate. How can you say that things that basically if the South would have won, we would have had it made, like Hank Jr. says in his song, right? That's what Winston Churchill is saying. How can you? So I just thought it was funny because I was trying to force people to pick. I'm like, all right, so you want to defend Winston Churchill, you know, the neo-Confederate, you know, choose one. Are you going to choose the Nazis or are you going to choose the Confederates? You can't have it both ways. So that's my humor. And I like to, with the complexity of history, when there's ideologues who just see everything in this super simple binary every time, I like to throw a little wrench in every now and then. So Chase Cliff says, it's like they are scared of the truth about World War II for some reason. Well, I'm going to end with this. World War II is our founding myth in many ways. Okay, you might say, wait, no, we have a founders. Yes, we do. But World War II has a special place. And I noticed this when I was in history class in my grad school. Oftentimes, when you're reading sources today, secondary sources on American slavery, it is read through a Holocaust lens. Plantations are referred to regularly as concentration camps. And it's crazy to me how this has transpired. But the Holocaust has become the worst, most evil thing that has ever. And of course, it was evil, but it has become the measuring rod. And everything that gets put into this category of Holocaust, whether it's slavery, whether it's MAGA, anti-immigration, whether it's anti-civil rights, whether it's whatever someone wants to put in there, whatever the left says is part of this, it ends up, I guess this is the F scale in a way, the fascist scale, right? You know, you respect your parents too much, you might be a fascist, but whatever the left puts in this category of Holocaust, Nazi, fascist, it's given the scarlet letter at that point. And once it has the scarlet letter, then your obligation is to denounce it, not even to think about it. And this is how they shoot down a lot of right-wing ideas. And it seems to me that what's, as far as a founding myth, what has happened is we look at ourselves as the good guys and having the moral superiority mainly because we defeated the Nazis, whether it's England and United States, the West. That's what legitimizes our existence. That's why we exist. That's why we're gifts to the world. And that's why the world should listen to us and not them, not Putin, right? Because Putin's another Nazi. Forget the fact he's fighting some bands of quote unquote neo-Nazis. He's the Nazi because we've said he is, because look, there's a parallel. Hitler invaded countries. He's invading a country, right? This is the moral play that gets played every time. And the problem is it is one experience, it's one sliver of experience from human history. And if we compare, if we put everything in that category, every single thing, there's a lot of things that don't fit that. Not every leader who wants to negotiate is Chamberlain. Not every leader who wants to fight is Churchill. Not every person who invades a country is Hitler. Not right. These are things that we just, we, when we have a current situation, we make Saddam Hussein Hitler. We make Putin Hitler. We make bin Laden Hitler. Like we just try. That's the core evil. That's the devil. That's the devil word. That's the worst thing. And you have to be opposed to it. And that's part of our identity, is we're opposed to it. And it's lurking everywhere. Part of the problem now on the left is the founding fathers are now being put into this category. Jefferson's, he's kind of a little Hitler, right? Because you know, he, what he supposedly did with Sally Hemings. And I say supposedly because I did, go check out the video I did with Mark Halochak on the Jefferson Hemings. He calls it a myth, but, that's what we do. And so Daryl Cooper is challenging that a bit. He's saying, look, this isn't the allies weren't pure as the driven snow. I think the allies, with the exception of the Soviets, I think that, yeah, they were the good guys in the sense that they did have, I think, a moral superiority. I'm not saying every person in that group. I'm not saying every world leader. But I think as a general effort, I believe, based on my, and I've taken on the graduate level, I guess here are my bona fides. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on World War II, but yes, I have taken a graduate level course on World War II. I've taken a graduate level course on the Holocaust. I do believe the Allies were, in general, the good guys. And yes, I'm probably biased because I'm an American and I also have family that I knew personally who fought in the 15th Air Force and then my grandpa in the South Pacific. And I think that what Hitler was trying to do was, as far as his, I think his aggression was wrong. And obviously what he did and, what ended up happening with the Holocaust and so forth was wrong. I also though think something else, and this is going to maybe surprise some of you, but one of the books that I had to read when I was in grad school was called The Bitter Road to Freedom. And it's about the Allied invasion, British and American mostly, of Europe from, I think it starts in D-Day and then it goes through the victory in Europe. And there's a few things I disagree with in it, but in general, the story it tells is pretty shocking. Venereal diseases breaking out in German towns because of the Allies. Soldiers that were involved in basically war crimes that were not punished for it. Whole entire cities leveled. You can go look back at the footage of what Berlin looks like, what many towns would, I mean, what's the worst one? I'm trying to remember the worst one that they always bring up. And now I don't know why it's escaping me. Dresden. But the Allies did, not saying all the Allies, I have family that I don't think did horrible things, but there were some horrible things that Allies did. And that's a book that I would commend to you. Now, there's horrible things that happened in war. That's the nature of war. And that's what a lot of people will say as an excuse. The Allies were the first ones, it was America, to drop atomic bombs on Japan. While they were having, had Japanese in their own, I guess, concentration camps in the United States. I mean, there's plenty to criticize about even the way the United States handled some of this. I think one of the points Daryl Cooper made, though, on the podcast, and I really appreciated this, is that whenever you actually study history and you're able to see things from multiple perspectives, you read accounts from multiple perspectives, you humanize people. and you lose that devil language. Now there's some people it's hard to do that with. It's some people that there's a book on John Brown that I remember I read. And it's hard to do that with someone like a John Brown, to be quite honest. But even a John Brown, I can humanize him. I think he was an ideologue most of his entire life. And he would have sacrificed probably his children for his greater cause. He did, basically. I mean, he did. They lived in poverty and squalor, and some of them probably died from disease because of he was a bad businessman, but he was also so distracted by his abolitionist stuff. Anyway, there's some really bad people out there, but oftentimes in any conflict, you look at Abraham Lincoln, you look at Jefferson Davis, you see two humans, and you can see things from their perspective in the conditions that they were in and why they might have made some of the decisions they made. You see George Washington, you see King George, you can see why they would. This is across the board. You may disagree with one of them. You may think he's wrong. You may think there's sin there, but you can see that there's also flaws maybe on the other side. This is the nature of history. When you start digging into primary sources, I'm telling you, it will happen to you. You can't avoid it. And that's what makes history somewhat interesting, because it is the story of human stories. And the cumulative experience of history makes one a wise person if you learn the lessons from it. It's much better than taking an abstraction like equality and saying the Nazis were against it, we were for it, World War II, and then comparing everything to that one event. That is essentially the post-war consensus. It is a simplified cartoon that compares everything. And I'm not saying the Allies weren't the right. I think they were. I'm not saying that I would have been on their side, obviously. I think it's for guys who want to go down the neo-Nazi route, and maybe that's not the right word. Someone told me I shouldn't use that word. I'm fine. So whatever, sympathetic to the Nazis, whatever. You're going to, it's a tough sell to Americans when their grandfathers, my grandfather, was fighting in that conflict. And I know where my sympathies lie, but I also know there's a great movie called Saints and Soldiers years ago that tried to show they were humans too. And many of them in the Nazi army were ignorant. They didn't even know that there was a Holocaust happening. I know that that's now a lot of historians are trying to say everyone knew it. They didn't. Many of them didn't. And they really genuinely thought they were doing their duty, their country. And there's a mutual respect soldiers have. And I thought it was a great film. There's another one I watched. I can't remember the title. A few years ago, it was about, it was a foreign film. I want to say maybe Swedish. I think it was Swedish or Norwegian. I can't remember. But it was about these Nazi boys, essentially, that they're just boys. And they were using them to take mines out to that I guess had been on the beaches and so forth. And many of them died and blew. And it was a heart wrenching thing to watch this thing, but it makes you see things from a wider perspective. And I think that's helpful. And that's how I see Darryl Cooper acting. So I'll get to the comments here in a minute, but I want to just read for you. This is from Return of the Strong Gods by Reno. And many people are confused about the post-war consensus. I read this a while ago, and this term comes up 123 times in the book. Here's how he defines it. I call the atmosphere of opinion that sustains these anti-imperatives, and these are anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-totalitarian, and anti-nationalist. So that's why Christian nationalism is scary, right? It says, I call the atmosphere of opinion that sustains these anti-imperatives the post-war consensus. Although there has been political contention between the left and the right, it has been a sibling rivalry. As I will show, the post-war left fixed its attention on moral freedom and cultural deregulation, seeing them as natural extensions of the anti-authoritarian imperative, while the post-war right focused on economic freedom and market deregulation for the similar anti-totalitarian reasons. As the long 20th century ends, this unified thrust is easier to discern, not least because the establishment left and right are closing ranks to denounce populism. The post-war consensus is more than political. Its powerful cultural influence is evident in the emphasis on openness and weakening in highly theorized literary criticism and cultural studies in universities, often under the flag of critique and deconstruction. and calls for diversity, multiculturalism, inclusivity, all of which entail a weakening of boundaries and opening of borders, nor is the cultural influence of the post-war consensus confined to the left. I'm going to stop reading there. He makes some excellent points, though. And what he's saying is that, look, there's a cartoon of history here which says, you know what the problem is with the Germans? They just were too stinking proud to be German. That's what it is. They were just too proud of themselves, and they got too big for their britches. And that's what led to them trying to take over Europe and kill groups of people that they didn't like. And if we get too nationalistic, you know, too nativist, too anti-immigrant, too embedded in our own culture and against multiculturalism, too obsessed or focused or privileging our own religion and not other religions, if we get too specific and we look at ourselves as a people and a place, blood and soil, right? If we look at ourselves more in these terms, if we appeal to those and not as this abstract proposition that anyone can be part of, we're going to do the Nazi thing again. And we're always in danger of that. And that's why you need to be vigilant and to fight. And it's always rearing its ugly head. It was interesting to me. I saw Russell Moore today on a podcast saying, so discouraged since 2020 that we've made so little progress and all the progress has been reversed. And I'm thinking, you took down hundreds of monuments. You quote unquote reformed, I don't know how many police departments. DEI is like in every institution now. And oh yeah, we failed. And the far right is gaining. This is how they think. The far right is always one breath away from taking over everything. As long as there's some kind of a specific pride in one's own and one's own in-group preference in a European context of some kind. And that would include America, Australia, South Africa, and maybe for the Boers in South Africa. Then we have Nazis. We have concentration camps coming. We have all these things. That is the post-war consensus. This is why people freak out with Christian nationalism, with anything that they say that sounds totalitarian, when it's like you're talking about blasphemy laws. You're saying, hey, maybe pornography should be illegal, let's say. And it's like, oh, it's totalitarian. It's offending the post-war consensus. That's what Reno is trying to say. And that's what Daryl Cooper, aka Martyr, made offended, because the lines are so specifically drawn. Hitler bad, Winston Churchill good, Winston Churchill the hero that saved the world. And if there's any questioning of Winston Churchill, like if you could have avoided World War II, right? If this wasn't the inevitable thing, then where's our moral justification for existing in the first place? And that's why I made the 1607 Project, because it existed there the whole time. We are a people. We are a place. We have unique ways about us, unique cuisine, unique political thought, unique music, religion. We have our own spin on everything. And we should be proud of those things. And that's part of it. So, all right, John Carter. John Carter from Mars, because that's a great movie. John Carter for $9.99 says, Soviet atrocities took place and were well known long before 1933. How then could any moral justification be given for allying with them before any camps were established in Poland? Yeah, good point. The Nazis also allied with the Soviets, though. Just remember that. That's a conveniently forgotten thing. But the Nazis at one time were also allied with them. The Soviets played both sides of that war. John Carter also sits for $4.99. If your pastor is more outraged by the Holocaust deniers than Christ deniers, it shows his true religion. Excellent point. LGBT people are the mission field. We're always told by Big Eva, but what about our Holocaust deniers, the mission field? Should we make our church welcoming to Holocaust deniers? They think the opposite on that. Right. And, you know, I just think that, the gospel goes out to everyone. Right. But when it comes to things the scripture calls sin, we shouldn't be bending over backwards to accommodate it. I certainly don't deny the Holocaust. And I think that, here's the thing though, if you even have a question about the official numbers, if you have a question about the, whether or not somewhere like Auschwitz had, used gas to not de-louse clothing, but to actually kill people. If you ever question, anything that's part, like there's a whole bunch of things that are part of the official narrative. If you question any of it, then you are a Holocaust denier, right? So, so I'm, you know, I took a whole class. I took literally a whole class on the graduate level, a Holocaust class. And I don't want to get off on this tangent too much, but I will say this. There was a whole book we had to read on called Why, and it was Why the Holocaust. And it doesn't really tell you the conditions of the Weimar Republic. It was in through my own study later that I realized why Jews were so vilified in Germany. The scapegoat theory and some of these other things don't seem to be the full picture. But anyway, all that to say, no, we have primary sources, guys. The Holocaust definitely happened. But I'm not the kind of guy that goes out there and says that if there's someone who has a different opinion on that topic, we should excise them from our churches and not share the gospel with them or not minister to them. I think those things can be talked about in conversations, but this is not the kind of, in fact, actually I have a friend from years ago that I did have these conversations with because these were questions and now everyone's questioning it. But when you talk about actual blasphemy, like the comparison shouldn't even be there. Like for a Christian, right? When you blaspheme the Lord of glory, like this is a horrible thing. The Bible talks about this in numerous places. So I don't know. I don't want to, this is probably gonna be clipped and I'm gonna call the Holocaust denier, even though I'm not, but it's one of those things that people don't want to talk about it because as soon as you even mention it, everyone's got its heightened awareness and they're so afraid they're on eggshells because this is part of our founding kind of mythos and why we see ourselves as the good guys. And we don't want to question any part of that story. It's a good white hat, black hat story. And I think that I actually think historically there is an element of that. There is a white hat, black, like there, I am proud of what my family achieved in World War II. And I'm specific to World War II because by the end of the lives of, I don't want to mention anyone specifically, but let's just say veterans I know, and I've heard this more than once, they thought that it was almost pointless what they had done. At the time, it seemed like they had done a lot of good. But then to see what happened with the Soviet Union and then communist China and how they became the world powers, were still dealing with communist China and to some extent the former Soviet Union. To see then what happened with liberalism in the West, even worse, degrading societies. Some of them wondered by the end of their lives and still wonder what were they fighting? What was the point of that? You know, the whole, at least they're not speaking German. And some of them think, if we're dealing with things that are so much worse. And it's the saddest thing when I see veterans do that. I have the utmost respect, though, for World War II veterans. And it brings a tear to my eye and inspiration to my soul. I mean, I was raised on legends of World War II. I was raised listening to older men talk about World War II. I was raised watching World War II movies, right? And all of those things. I want my kids to be, I want them to see some of the films that I saw and read some of the books that I read and that kind of thing. But I'm also mature enough to know there's evil people on the ally side. And that's really, I think all this comes down to is, and there's mistakes that were made and that's the nature of war. And I don't think it's wrong for Darryl Cooper to have the opinion that, this, maybe the war could have been avoided if Winston Churchill had not done this, this, and this. I'm saying he's making an argument, and to just dismiss him as some kind of a Nazi exposes, I think, you more than it does Darryl Cooper, in my opinion. So again, maybe watch tomorrow, Darryl Cooper is going to come out and say Hitler was right or something. And I'm going to have to be like, oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Well, as far as I know, that's not Darryl Cooper's position. In fact, I think he said stuff against Hitler, if I'm not mistaken, in the podcast. All right. I'll take any questions. we're getting into all the controversial territory. Isn't this great? I have to watch John Carter now. You definitely have to watch John Carter. I mean, it was that movie is, I love that movie. And it's so, maybe I'm weird, it's rated very low. I don't think critics liked it and fans didn't like it. I loved it. So go watch John Carter. It's such an oversimplification of human actions, motive, bonds of all kinds, many other factors that play into every action or reaction we have in life. And this is true in everyday life. Yeah. Kat Holtz, both my grandparents were in the Navy in World War II. One of my grandpas was on the ship seen in the picture of the flag raising of Iwo Jima. Can I tell you a story, Kat? I want to tell you a story about that, the flag raising of Iwo Jima, since we're nerding out on World War II now. I was in Lynchburg, Virginia, and I had my own furniture repair business. And I went to, literally, it's right outside of Liberty University. There is this apartment complex, beautiful apartment complex. But it's almost close enough to be on the campus. And I went there, and I was servicing, I think it was sofa or something, in someone's apartment. And it was an older guy. He was a World War II vet. And as is my habit, if I see someone who's a veteran with a hat on or something, I say, thank you for your service. And I hope all of you listening to this podcast, I hope you do that if you see that. And if you see a World War II vet out there today, boy, that's rare. But this was a few years ago, and there were still a few of them around. When I went to Pearl Harbor, I met some. I mean, it was amazing. I don't think there's any left that are probably still out there talking to people. My grandfather died this year. He was a World War II vet, 101 years old. Anyway, I went into this apartment, and this guy had all these pictures. He's a Marine. And I start talking to him, and he shows me. He said, I'll show you my book, my photo book. And so he has the picture of the flag raising at Iwo Jima. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, you have that popular picture. And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, the photographer gave it to me. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, the guy who took the picture gave it to me. I never realized it was going to become popular. And I said, whoa, hold on. The person who took, I don't remember, he knew the name, but the person who took that picture of the flag raising of Iwo Jima, he goes, yeah, I knew him. He just gave me a copy of it. This was before any newspaper. No one had, that wasn't an iconic picture yet. It wasn't in DC as a statue, and he had that picture. It's a special memory, and I'll be able to tell my kids and my grandkids that I knew someone who knew the guy who took that picture, but he was a Marine island hopping in the South Pacific. He had one story he told me of this fighter plane that he lands on the island, and he landed on the airstrip. The Japanese guy just casually walked out. He was surrendering, which is a rare thing, I guess. And they arrested him and stuff. But all right. Kat also says, I was cutting hair and this guy came in, we started talking, and we had some copies of a signed picture from the guys from the original flag raising he gave me to give to my grandpa. Wow. I wonder, it's funny. Like, maybe this guy knew your grandpa. It's just World War II stuff is, I mean, Stephen Wolf talks about this. Like, it's a shared experience. It's traumatic, but it's a shared experience. And when you, it doesn't matter if one family's black, one family's white, one family's from California, one family's from Nevada. Well, Nevada's too close. Alabama, we'll say. These differences are somewhat spanned when you have these shared experiences. And you can look back and say, where were you in that conflict? And it's one of the things that keeps, see, that more than the post-war consensus, I think actually contributes to who Americans are, that shared experience. I keep hearing from military men that I've met and talked to. In many ways, I'm thankful that circumstances prevent me from joining the military. Yeah, I wanted to join the military too, and circumstances prevented me from that, mostly health things. And looking back now, I'm glad. Which flag raising, the first or the second? I think they did it the second. The photograph's the second, right? Because the first one, there's no photograph. Where's the balance of respecting veterans, but also being real about the state of our country? Well, I think veterans from some of these, I see World War II as legitimate. We were attacked by the Japanese. They were in a pact with Hitler. And of course, we were doing lend lease and these kinds of things. But yeah, we were provoked and we went to war. I think it's legitimate. Some of these other conflicts since then, I mean, look at the last one. I mean, Afghanistan and Iraq, it gets a little harder. I think you don't have to. So this is something that's true. There are veterans who go in for noble reasons, soldiers who go in for noble reasons, believing what their leaders tell them. And they find out later that maybe they weren't given the whole picture, and maybe the cause was not as just as they thought. And maybe the long-term effects of what they did were not good. But you respect them for their willingness to sacrifice, suffer deprivation to protect the people they love, which is you. And so you thank them for their service. I think that's what you do. Because it's also, it's a part of, it's a we, it's an us. This is part of, you were protecting us. That's why you did it. I do think, though, it's going to get more difficult going forward. If we get involved, let's say in Ukraine, something like that, and it's obvious, like, we're not there for good reasons, then, and the soldiers, you know, they're not duped into this, but they go along, they're like mercenaries, then this does become something different, I think. It's just sad that we have to, as Americans, start thinking in these ways. But, you know, like, I have family on both sides of the Civil War, right? Obviously, I don't know them. They're not still alive. But I think I probably have more Southern soldiers. But I do have some Northern ones from Iowa and maybe from Ohio. I know from Iowa. But the thing is, you know, you have two sides. I think that the North, I think that Lincoln should not have called for troops. I don't think that. I think this could have been averted, right? Which gets me in the same kind of trouble that it got Darryl Cooper for saying that maybe World War II could have been averted if cooler heads had prevailed. I honor both, though. I think there should be. There's a Union War Memorial down the street from where I live right now. And I would, if someone went and spray painted that thing or tried to vandalize it, tried to take it down, I'd stand against it. I really would. Because the reason it's there is because of the veterans who did think that they were going in for a noble cause, to preserve the Union was what they were told. And I think, I don't know, I there's more I could say about that, but I do think that you can spot honor on both sides of many conflicts. Our war with Japan was legitimate, not in Europe. Well, kind of hard when as soon as you go to war with Japan, that ties you into being in war in Europe. Germany declared war on us. So, you know, they were in alliance with Japan. So what are you going to do? The photographer who took the second flag raising picture of Iwo Jima died 2 weeks after the photograph was taken. He never saw it. This is well documented. Okay, well, that's the story I was told. So I don't know then. I didn't think there was a first. I didn't think they captured it the first time. So I don't know how you square that then with what this Marine told me. Now you're ruining my story. You know that, Jason? You're ruining my story. He told me the photographer gave it to him. Maybe he was confused, or maybe it was someone who said they were the photographer. I don't know. I heard there was another flag raising on a different location, but it was a Confederate battle flag by troops in honor of their South Carolina captain. This is true. Yes. That was on Iwo Jima, I believe. And yeah, there was a Confederate Southern Cross that was raised on Iwo Jima. You don't often see that, but yeah, I've seen the picture. A lot of soldiers in World War II, in Vietnam, even through the Gulf War, had Southern symbols, and they were considered American. It wasn't controversial at the time. In fact, the military was using Stonewall Jackson and some of these Southern icons to recruit. I wonder how long until the European Civil War becomes the official name of the conflict, as Ernst Note called it with his book. Yeah, and I wonder whether or not in the future World War I and World War II will be linked in their treatments as the same war, basically. My boomer uncle was outraged when I told him FDR's stated objective was to provoke Japan into committing the first overt act of war to overrule American public opinion to join the war against Germany. Oh, I really don't want to take the bait on. It's not bait, but I don't want to go down that path this late. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it was known that Japan was doing this, and FDR kind of let it happen. Or at least there's a lot of suggestion. I've seen a lot of compelling things that lead you to believe that. I'll leave it there. They did still attack, though, and you know, they did punch first, right? I guess you could say, well, we didn't get, you know, we were not going to supply them with oil, and they needed that, but. And, you know, there was the Flying Tigers, and, you know, we had units, I guess, in China helping out in limited capacities. Didn't Patton's grandfather fight with Stonewall Jackson? I think so. That's probably true. There's a lot of Kerry Roberts did a great speech years ago. He talks about the hills that the Confederate soldiers had to take during the war. And that many of them, their great, you know, their grandsons, great grandchildren, whatever, that they took those hills and they were inspired by the ghosts of Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee and so forth. And the reason it's compelling when he said that, and it was in a speech, was because the world wars were really the unification of the country. It was a fractured country in many ways. And the Southerners proved they were willing to die for the United States. They were willing to fly that flag after having such a contentious war. And there was a reconciliation that took place. And we're unwinding all of that now. We unwound all of it. It's the saddest thing. Romania, Hungary, Albania, etc. begged us to free them from the Nazis. They didn't want the Russians to do that. Churchill wanted to do that. FDR nixed it. Well, it's a whole lot better to be freed by the Americans than the Germans even knew this, than the Soviets. The Eastern Front was not where you wanted to be. That was like a punishment to go to the Eastern Front. All right, I have to stop, guys. I'm so sorry, but I would suggest, read that book. It's a starter pack in my mind for if you want to just see things in color a little bit more, read that book, The Bitter Road to Freedom. And there's another book that's, what's it called? Okay, it's just World War II. This is a Holocaust thing, but it's of all the books, I've read a lot of books on the Holocaust, let me tell you. So of all the books I've read, though, this one stood out to me the most, Ordinary Men. And it's about these Nazi death squads. They would take these ordinary guys who weren't fighting in the war effort for whatever reason, older, had issues, whatever. And they would basically give them access to like prostitution and alcohol and all these things to numb their consciences. And then basically tell them to go to the forests and kill Jews. They'd line them up and kill them. It's a horrible thing. And the psychological damage that did to, it was spiritual damage really, that did their souls. So this guy tracked them and said it was a crazy number of them that committed suicide later. They couldn't live with themselves. And it's books like that that make me think like this is something the Nazis did to their own people. These were people that they should not have been put in that position. I'm talking about both Jewish people that were killed, but also and others. It wasn't just Jewish people, but also these ordinary men. And anyway, sobering book, and not for the faint of heart. But but it's cool that America makes a movie called The Dirty Dozen. Man, don't get me started on that stuff. Yeah, especially in Inglourious. I won't even repeat the name of the title. Horrible Quentin Tarantino movie. I couldn't even watch it. The way that they just depersonize people. So, all right, we're done. End of live stream. God bless, guys. More coming later in the week, Lord willing, by now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.